could not have predicted the first time that our guest today was on the show a year and a half ago that we would be in really such a watershed moment in American history. COVID-19 has disproportionately affected people of color across the country, and the deaths of George Floyd, Ahmaud Arbery, and Breonna Taylor have sparked massive protests calling for racial equality and justice across the globe. I'm honored to have her back here today on the program. Please welcome Dr. Carol Anderson, the Charles Howard Candler, Professor of African American Studies at Emory University, and author of the New York Times bestselling books, White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Nation's Divide, and One Person, No Vote, How Voter Suppression is Destroying Our Democracy. Please welcome Dr. Carol Anderson to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I know that you've been out and about, right? A whole bunch of interviews, but I just want to know how you're doing. How are you holding up through all of this, you know, as a woman of color?
That is the sweetest. Thank you. I've got to say, it's hard. And it steals my determination to keep on doing the work that I'm doing so that the next generation or the folks next year don't have to feel this. I'm working on a new book, and the chapter I'm on right now, I've entitled American Carnage. And I'm dealing in this chapter with, you know, I'm researching, you know, the deaths from the end of the Civil War through World War II. And it's one lynching after the next, one massacre, one pogrom, one state level violence against Black folk. And, you know, and I'm doing this from the late 19th century to the early 20th. And then I come up from my research and I see this. And it's why we must fight. It's why we must continue to do this work. It's why we must unveil and make legible how these systems of oppression work that look so reasonable, that look so justifiable, but in fact, what they are is lethal.
It's interesting you talk about that, because in your book, White Rage, you call that kind of the kindling, that we pay so much attention to the flames that we forget the kindling. And it feels like in this moment that there is a multi-generational coalition that's standing over that kindling with a bucket of water saying, not today. I'm not playing, not today.
Yes.
So describe what you mean by the kindling, and if you think more people are paying attention to it.
I think so many more people are paying attention to it. The kindling, you know, it's I've said, you know, I wrote White Rage in the face of Ferguson, and seeing all of those pundits talking about, ooh, look at Black folk burning up where they live. Well, can you believe Black folk are burning up where they live? And, you know, what kind of people burn up where they live? And they're just all focused in on the flames, and the cameras are there, and they're like, woo. And I'm looking at that saying, and they're talking about all this Black rage. And I'm looking at that going, no, son. That is white rage. Those are the policies that result in the fire. The policies that systematically strip African-Americans of their citizenship rights. The policies that push back all of the hard work and advancements that African Americans have had, the policies that are designed to douse the aspirations of Black people for their full humanity. And those policies come through the criminal justice system, they come through legislation, they come through the White House, they come through the governor's mansion, zoning boards, school boards, city councils, mayor's offices. All of these policies that look so mundane and bureaucratic with their sometimes esoteric or dense language, but the very core of those policies is how do we keep Black folk in their subordinate place? How do we stop African Americans from believing that they have rights as citizens, as human beings? And what we see today, and I think it's a convergence of the kinds of crises that we're in. So what we see today are people really beginning to understand and grapple with, to find out this massive quest to understand how we got here. So those crises, the crises of COVID-19 that has claimed more than 120 lives in the United States, more than 2 million have contracted the disease, and yet the United States had the wherewithal to shut that thing down. And the political leaders made a conscious decision not to do so. And so it put people's lives on the line. The vulnerability of that was like, what? And although it has disproportionately hit Black folk, it's hitting everybody. And I think that, so that's one of the streams that is leading to the question about the policies, the kindling. Mm. I think one of the other streams is the economic collapse in the United States. Double digit unemployment, businesses closed, small businesses struggling, food lines stretching from here to eternity. The voting crisis, where we're seeing lines, where we're having politicians who are putting American citizens before a COVID-19 firing squad just to be able to exercise their right to vote.
It's interesting you say that, because while there are eyes on this, and you look at some of the major corporations, and you talk about this in the book, that with every step forward, they're kind of two steps back almost for Black folk in the country. And you look at almost every corporation, Netflix, Reed Hastings giving away $120 million to Morehouse and Spelman. You have Walmart coming out definitively. Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos said on his Instagram, "I don't want you to shop at Amazon if you support Black Lives Matter, if you don't support Black Lives Matter," and that Amazon stands with the movement for racial equality. It seems like, as positive as that is, that this is poised to set up a massive white lash.
And so this is where we have to be really careful about the performance of equality versus the substance of equality. And it's not to say that those actions of providing financial support, of declaring, of creating a norm where the destruction of Black people is not acceptable. There is no piece of that that is a bad thing. Let me be really clear on that. But it is not the alpha and the omega. It is not the start and the end, because we didn't get here at this point where a police officer can put his knee on a Black man's neck for 8 minutes and 46 seconds and believe that he has immunity from any kind of consequences for that. And we didn't get here overnight where police can push down a 75-year-old white man and crack his head on the sidewalk, blood pooling out of his head, blood pooling out of his ear, and the police just walk by as if there is not a human being suffering right there in front of them. That didn't happen overnight, and no quick gesture is going to dismantle the norms and the institutions that created that. And so it's the beginning, and we have to acknowledge that it's the beginning, and it's a good beginning, but it's only where we start.
But even in that performative nature, as you're saying, and I agree with that, the performing nature of having all of these corporations say, hey, this is where we stand, that seems like that aggravates those who subscribe to white supremacy, maybe unconsciously, but who feel like their country is being taken away from them, right? And to see the companies that they support, that they have shopped at, say, if you believe that, you're not welcome here anymore. Even though it's performative, I still think that that could lead to an even bigger massive white lash. Do you agree with that?
You know, and it's going to be there. The only way you don't have that kind of white lash, that white backlash, that white rage, is if you're willing to subjugate everybody in the United States to white supremacy. If you are willing to be just fine with people working from kink to kink and they still kink. If you're willing to be fine with the police can beat you senseless, and that's all right. If you're fine with massive wealth disparities, massive income disparities, massive education disparities, and you don't believe you have the right to better, that's the only way you don't get white lash. Now, I don't know too many folk willing to subject themselves to that. So the white lash is going to come. The thing is that you denorm that thing. You don't give it justifiable room, but you make sure that it is revealed for what it is. And that a society that is as multiracial, multi-ethnic, multi-generational as this one, that its vibrancy is the thing that is embraced and fostered and nurtured, and the hatred that says that somehow this is my country, that therefore does massive erasure to the history of Native Americans, massive erasure to the history, the unpaid labor, centuries of Black people. And then the disproportionate unfunding, disfunding, not funding the labor of Black people since. That it ignores the incredible role of Asian Americans in building this country, of Hispanics in building this country, of Muslims in building this country. This is all of our country. It's not just a sliver of white folks' country.
You mentioned denorming, and I don't know if it's sad that I'm shocked, but even more people have been killed in the hands of police custody. I saw on Twitter, which, you know, you know, don't take that as a, you know, take that with a grain of salt, but over 120 people, right, have died. And then there are cases that are just seeing the light of day now, that happened a year ago. But because of the newfound attention to this, they're making their way through. Is it sad that I'm shocked by the brazen nature that even in this moment, when the lights are on bright, we are trying to expose it, we have a black light, we are searching for these, that bad actors are still killing us?
Mm-mm, mm-mm. You know, old Southern saying, a dying mule kicks hardest.
Oh my goodness.
Right. You know, understand that this, as they used to say in the movement, this is going to be no easy walk. That the sense of impunity is deeply embedded. You saw the tapes that just came out with the Wilmington police, three of them talking about killing Black folk and starting another civil war so they can get rid of as many Black people as they possibly can. One of the things that I think is being revealed in this, and that is really frustrating, and this is why we see all of this, you know, what they call the blue flu of police officers just not showing up for work, is that there had been, again, this norm of police are here to protect and serve. This norm of when the police officer says it, whatever they say, that's the truth. And when that is questioned, you know, just like an abuser who gets questioned, the abuser doesn't stop, but the abuser doubles down on the abuse to make you stop saying it, to make you stop seeing that abuse, to make you stop calling it out. And that's what, you know, so when the NYPD gives a press conference talking about we're being treated like criminals, we're not being respected. But what we saw the NYPD pushing people down, beating people who were just on a bicycle, spraying people with mace who were just standing there. That calling into question has only made the fury of the audacity to call it into question come out. And the saying that, well, then you won't get police protection. And I liken that to, years ago, there was a physician named Michael Swango, and he killed over 60 of his patients in various hospitals. Yes, a doctor killing his patients. Now imagine if someone said, the only health care you can get is Michael Swango. You either get Swango or nothing.
I would say nothing.
Hello!
Goodness gracious.
Right, but you see how that sets up a false choice. That yes, right, you would like medical care, good medical treatment. What Swango is bringing is not that. That cannot be the only option. It's a false binary. And so when you have this blue flu, when you're hearing a Bill Barr, the attorney general, say, you know, for those communities that don't respect the police, they may not just get the protection they want. That's a choice between Swango and nothing. It's a false choice.
And speaking of choices, a lot of young people who have been out in the streets have been calling for the defunding of the police, which is essentially moving resources from these exorbitant police budgets to social services on the front end. Your thoughts on kind of the defunding the police, and more specifically how some conservatives have kind of twisted what the meaning of that phrase is?
Of course they're going to twist it. I mean, it, you know, you have conservatives talking about, we only want what Martin Luther King wants. So.
Oh God, I haven't heard that one. Oh right, my.
You know, right. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. You know, we only want to be, you know, people to be judged by the content of their character, not by the color of their skin. And I love how they just cherry pick Martin Luther King, because if they really knew Martin Luther King, read Martin Luther King. So the know that the rhetorical twist on defunding police as a way to hide what the demand is really about. And it is when you see the militarization of the police. And, you know, and that was something that the Obama administration had stopped and that the Trump administration had re-upped again, is giving all of this and selling all of this military equipment to police. Is that you've got police, and I love the New York Times did a study recently, and they looked at 4, 5, or 6 different police forces around the nation. And they found that only 4% of a police officer's time was spent on violent crimes. 4%. So you might ask yourself, now self, what happened with the other 96%? And it is that 96% that you're hearing about, well, police aren't capable and trained to deal with mental health crises. So why don't we put the money that we're giving the police for that into mental health professionals who can help the people who need that kind of help? Police aren't trained to deal with, and fill in the blank. You know, so you get this thing about police in schools, right? Well, what we know is that the police in schools have they've created a pre-carceral system in the schools where Black children are handcuffed. I mean, you see a 6-year-old Black girl being handcuffed. You have a young Black woman being body slammed in the classroom. It's on and on. And so we begin to think about, what do our schools really look like when they are not pre-carceral states? What do we need to make our education system function? And so these ideas, I love it, the imagining, reimagining, what does safety really look like? Safety doesn't look like Michael Swingo. Safety doesn't look like Officer Chauvin.
But what's so interesting about the reaction here too is that by almost attacking the institution, we're attacking our, like you mentioned, our subordination, and how somehow that has been tied to what America is and the definition of America. And especially you see the Confederate monuments as well, you know, people are tearing them down and people are saying, don't take away my heritage. That's my history. And so whiteness and white supremacy are being linked in this way. And what's funny about it, not funny, but sad, ignorant about it, is that they don't even realize it.
Well, you know, you get this weird kind of, Robert E. Lee was a good man. Ooh. And I think about the kind of veneration that happens when you put these Confederate monuments in the public square. And when we think about the timing of these Confederate monuments, and you think about even having a Confederate monument, because at bare doggone minimum, these were folks that attacked the United States of America and tried to destroy it. So you have states that are praising in the public square traitors. Wow. Would we have a monument to Timothy McVeigh? Mm. And so.
Yeah, well, no, I mean.
Exactly, right?
I just want to make sure that that's on the record. That's a no, folks.
So somehow we get that. And I don't see a statue to Benedict Arnold. But for Robert E. Lee and Jefferson Davis, those who said the United States cannot stand, and we will attack it. We attacked Fort Sumter. We killed hundreds of thousands of Americans and wounded over 1 million more. Mm. We did everything we can. we conspire to try to get Britain and France to attack the United States on our side. Hmm. Wow. And the response to that is, and so it, you begin to get this kind of sense that the United States is less important than white supremacy. Mm. That holding up white supremacy is the most important thing. And if that means the destruction of the United States of America, then so be it.
I find it rich for some. And there was a famous viral video of an African-American woman who said, you know, the social construct was broken. I don't give a damn about a target. I find it very rich for some individuals to say, well, you know, I support a peaceful protest. And, you know, I think that that's the right way to go, when time after time, whether it's the Confederacy or in Tulsa, the continual looting and slavery itself, looting of our bodies and looting of our businesses and our wealth and our equity. What do you say to the young people who are like, you know what, screw it. An eye for an eye, you took from us. I don't give a damn about your target.
And I look at that. So I've got several things going on in there. So, so one of them is that to equate a structure that systematically destroys your life and put that on par with property damage, that is, again, a false binary. It is Michael Swango or nothing. And it's diversionary. It is designed to distract from what is really going on. And two, the thing about, well, you know, we like peaceful protests. Well, I'm here to tell you, no, you don't. when Colin Kaepernick took a knee, oh my gosh, it was like he burned down a billion targets.
Mm-hmm. It was.
And you had the NFL in an uproar. You had Trump talking about he doesn't respect our troops. He hates the flag.
And calling players sons of B-words, which I can't say on the air.
Exactly. None of that had to deal, none of that dealt with what the protest was about. The state violence raining down on Black people and killing them. And so he gets banned from the NFL because he protested peacefully. So the "we like peaceful protest" is really not accurate. Right. Again, what those like Trump like, no protest whatsoever. That you accept your subordinate place. And the refusal of people to accept their subordinate place is what all the turmoil is about. The refusal to accept that equity and equality and justice are what people are demanding and that they have a right to. And that's why that strata of folk like Trump and company are so afraid. And so they are fighting back with everything that they have. But the people are stronger.
Mm. I think that's the perfect way to end. Dr. Carol Anderson, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Carol Anderson is the Charles Howard Candler Professor of African American Studies at Emory University and New York Times bestselling author of White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Nation's Divide, and One Person, No Vote, How Voter Suppression is Destroying Our Democracy. They're available wherever books are sold. Until next time, bye everybody.